This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico that's going on right now. Is this actually an inside job? Is there more to the story? Well, if you ask conspiracy theorists, their answer is inevitably going to be yes.
Around the campfire, humans tell horror stories about goblins and dark conspiracies of death. Soon after the shock of the BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, the cranks rolled out new tales that tell us a lot about the human mind and how we react to environmental tragedy. While the deadly rig explosion, the oiled wildlife, and the lost jobs are no joke, I can't resist rating the wildest theories coming from non-existent mystics, far-out blogs, right-wing radio, and even mainstream TV. Radio EcoShock rates the Gulf conspiracy theories. We will start with the dumbest and crawl up toward the surface where time may prove a few strange stories may be just too true. Since Judge Judy turned down our request, we'll have our panel of robots rate every theory. Starting with number one, the stupidest story on the net. You see, the North Koreans sent a torpedo into the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig. That's right, according to Sorcha Fall, host of the WhatDoesItMean.com news site, a North Korean mini-submarine with a suicide crew from the 17th Sniper Corps used torpedoes to sink the big rig. Recall the North Koreans had just been suspected of using a torpedo to sink a South Korean Navy vessel, so the public was primed for this fantastic rumor. Why did the North Koreans do it? To get back at the Southerners. You see, Hyundai Heavy Industry, that South Korean giant, built the Deepwater Horizon. But the plot goes deeper. The North Koreans knew that nothing could stop this Gulf leak, short of a nuclear bomb. The Russians used nuclear weapons to stop some natural gas blowouts on land. The Americans would be forced to use a nuke, and that would put them in a bad light. When they tried to renegotiate a nuclear weapons treaty, which helps North Korea, who wants to be a nuclear power. You see how it all fits now, don't you? This report supposedly comes from Russia's Northern Fleet. Who can verify that? And it's reported by Sorcha Fall. She claims to be Sister Maria Teresa, the 73rd Sorcha Fall of the Sorcha Fall Order. You need to send lots of money to find out more. Speculation on the web is that Sorcha Fall was created by the psychic and conspiracy theorist and computer programmer David Booth. Let's go to the panel. Your rating on the Gulf oil spill caused by the North Koreans. Right. A close second goes to conservative talk show nut Lush Limbo. He thinks the eco-terrorist did it.
I want to get back to the timing of the blowing up, the explosion out there in the Gulf of Mexico of this oil rig. Lest we forget, ladies and gentlemen, the carbon tax bill, cap and trade, that was scheduled to be announced on Earth Day. The cap and trade bill was strongly criticized by hardcore environmentalist wackos because it supposedly allowed more offshore drilling and nuclear plants. What better way to head off more oil drilling, nuclear plants, than by blowing up a rig? I'm just noting the timing here.
Mm-hmm. I can just see Greenpeace loading up a Zodiac with explosives to attack the drilling rig. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. To save the Gulf from oil drilling, we need to wreck the Gulf. Panel? Running a close third for Zany, conspiracy theorist in chief Alex Jones. Alex is a longtime advocate for the oil industry in his native Texas, claiming to have family in the oil business. He campaigns against the idea of peak oil and constantly says global warming is a plot by Al Gore and the faceless elitists to enslave Americans through the carbon tax. For a while after the Gulf spill, Jones was uncharacteristically quiet, but finally, since that is what everyone wants to talk about, and he is a talk show host, and since his whole radio empire depends on generating new conspiracies, Alex stepped into the octagon.
I was on Coast to Coast AM last night in the first hour, and George Norrie asked me what I thought about the BP spill, and I told him, that all the evidence points towards a false flag attack. And I've got Paul Watson and Steve Watson working the last week researching the oil spill. The definitive report, now 40-plus days after, will be published in the next 2 hours at PrisonPlanet.com. We've all been working on it together. It's not 100% that it's staged, but all the evidence points towards it being staged. And it is 100% that they are allowing it to continue and that they want it to be a bigger disaster as a pretext, as the Washington Post reported last week, for Obama to pass his new carbon tax, a wellhead tax, a gas pump tax, a energy tax, all levied in the name of cleaning up the Gulf.
Following up on the website at Infowars.com, we find out more. The rig was probably blown up on purpose by Obama and the elites in order to enslave Americans through the carbon tax. Just fill in the usual suspects, the Bilderbergers, the bankers, the Rothschilds, whoever you have been programmed to hate. They did it, not BP. On Prison Planet, ranter Paul Joseph Watson and Alex Jones say, quote, evidence points to BP oil spill false flag. False flag operations, they tell us, are used by the elite globalists to start wars or delude the public into following their nefarious plots for world domination. Exactly why BP would risk billions of dollars or even their corporate existence to help this plot by the world elite, we are not told. Panel, any takers for Alex Jones?
Actually, we are two laboratory mice who wish to be on your show as part of an intricate plan to take over the world.
Moving slightly away from total improbability, we find more strange things leaking out of the Gulf. For example, Dr. James P. Wickstrom tells us, quote, what U.S. scientists are forbidden to tell the public about the Gulf, oil volcano pressure too strong for containment. That was published on globalresearch.ca, a well-known ultra-conservative Canadian website, but then suddenly removed. It still shines on at rents.com, that site that always finds something Jewish to hate. Dr. Wickstrom promises that everything in the Gulf, going 50 miles inland, will be totally wrecked. That will happen because, are you ready? The huge oil reserve will gush out until finally seawater falls down into the underground cavity miles below the seabed. The seawater will be turned into steam by the heat down there, leading to an explosion that caves in the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. That creates a tsunami that will wipe out the entire Gulf, 50 miles inland. Perfectly reasonable, if you like science fiction. Who is James P. Wickstrom? A scientist, perhaps? According to this Wikipedia entry, quote, he is a far-right radio talk show host as well as a Christian identity minister who resides in Rhodes, Michigan. He is known for his strong opinions on racial issues, globalization, and Jews. He is also noted to be intensely anti-communist, end quote. Again, the far-right radio, Rents, Jack Blood, Alex Jones. In fact, I found most of the juiciest plots come from extreme radio, where Rush Limbaugh almost looks like a nice guy. Jack Blood, a host on the Deep South Gold Bug Network, GCN, gives us not one but, quote, 10 suspects and motives as to why the Gulf oil spill was an inside job, end quote. Oh, they are sounding like Obama comparing it to 9/11 here. Conspiracy writer Victor Thorne also wonders if the Gulf oil spill was an inside job. The same language moves on from site to site. He manages to connect all the dots from the Bilderbergers through the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds straight to Al Gore. Good job, Victor. Talk show host Melvin Levin thinks Obama sent SWAT teams to the Gulf rigs as the first step towards his long-held communist goals of nationalizing the oil industry. And there was a giant echo chamber of right-wing bloggers. Is it just coincidence that the Republicans and those further right support the oil industry and blame anyone other than BP for this Gulf gusher? Who writes these talking points, I wonder? Take the right-wing nut, please. This New Jersey blogger calls himself a small subsidiary of the vast right-wing conspiracy, end quote. There we find breathless reporting like, quote, see, we established yesterday that the key player in the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill conspiracy cover-up was Rahm Emanuel, who had the cash and the contacts to make the accident happen. Perhaps he did it to save Obama from himself or from the hard left, but the question still remains, did Obama order the explosion, or was he clueless about the entire operation? End quote. Well, yes, we want answers. Did Obama order the explosion of the Deepwater Horizon so he could expose himself, opening up the coast for more oil drilling? So he could help Goldman Sachs? The Jersey Nut, as he calls himself, is building on a report from another right-wing Christian site, WorldNet Daily. They discovered, and this may be useful if true, that Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, and I quote here from the Jersey Nut, lived for 5 years rent-free in an apartment owned by Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut, and her husband, Stanley Greenberg, whose consulting firm was a prime architect in BP's efforts to recast itself as a green corporation, and recipients of hundreds of thousands of dollars awarded through a committee chaired by Emanuel, end quote. I'm not saying Obama and his staff didn't get money from BP. I'm just wondering if it suited their interests to blow up the Gulf. Of course, it all makes sense once the Jersey Nut realizes, quote, a Zionist plot by Israel firsters looking to destroy America's domestic energy supply, thus making us more dependent on Mideast oil and more involved in the region's and Israel's security, end quote. It was the Jews. It always is, according to these twisted minds. Even the alleged mainstream media dabbled in the oily waters. I was alarmed to hear former Bush White House spokeswoman Dana Perino suggesting the blowout could be a deliberate attack. Fox News chewed on the edges of that for a while. But let's move on from the bizarre to the slightly possible. The Wayne Madsen report combines the probable with the really far out. He quotes informed sources suggesting Florida could face both water shortages and power blackouts due to the Gulf oil hitting that coast. The water, that comes from, quote, if the thick crude oil from the Deepwater Horizon disaster clogs the seawater intakes at the largest seawater desalinization plant in the United States, the Tampa Bay Seawater Desalinization Plant at Apollo Beach in Tampa, Florida, end quote. Ditto the water intakes that cool the Crystal River Nuclear Power Plant on the Gulf Coast just 80 miles north of Tampa. If oil hits those intakes, the nuclear power plant may have to shut down, removing a major source of power to the state of Florida. Well, that does sound possible to me. Then we have the big money conspiracies. I expect we'll learn a lot more about the timelines and the money moving before this disaster is over. We were shocked to find a BP memo 6 days before the blowout calling this drilling project a disaster. How long did top people know there was an extreme risk on Deepwater Horizon? Inquiring minds are already digging into the sale of 4 million shares of BP stock by Goldman Sachs while it was high on the market on March 31, 2010. It seems strange that Peter Sutherland, a longtime high-ranking executive in BP, was also managing director of Goldman Sachs International. Was there a pipeline between those two giant corporations? What did they know and when? And why did BP CEO Tony Hayward sell off millions of dollars of his shares, a third of his holdings, just 1 month before this disaster? This looks like there is a lot for conspiracy theorists to chew away on. But I digress. How about this theory? The Gulf leak cannot be fixed because BP tapped into an underground current of oil welling up from the earth itself. Yes, according to some obscure Russians, and touted by author and writer F. William Engdahl, oil is not made from compressed plant matter at all. There is an endless supply of oil because it is a natural lubricant generated by the earth itself, that so-called abiogenic theory. In a June 10th article at financialsense.com, Engdahl predicts the Gulf spill, quote, could go on for years, end quote. He cites Viktor Kucherov, professor at the Royal Institute of Technology in Sweden and the Russian State University of Oil and Gas. BP supposedly drilling into a migration channel, as he calls it, similar in size to the fabulous Ghawar field in Saudi Arabia. How about a rating from our panel? Now we move to a more difficult case. Is longtime oil analyst and industry investment banker Matt Simmons crazy or right? Simmons appeared on the Dylan Madigan program on MSNBC, saying that BP was messing around with the wrecked pipes and the blowout preventer, which were mildly leaking, while the real big leak could be 7 miles away.
Well, first of all, I had the luxury this morning finally, because I now have the video streaming of the leak. And it's interesting, when you look at the riser, and you realize you're looking at a 21.5-inch circumference riser, and there looks like somewhere between a 6- and 7-inch rip on the top. So the stuff coming out, it looks like a lot, but I actually saw a white fish go through it and come out white. So I said, this isn't the same as this brown, gooey, orange stuff that they found in the plume 7 miles away. And I still believe that what happened is that the riser blew off the wellhead and is hooked onto the rig. So you've got a mile of oil inside that that's pretty light concentrate. So that's what they're actually trying to get out. So it's not sure that luckily they placed the top kill correctly, but now they have to see if it'll take mud. It probably will take mud. But then they shouldn't delude themselves that they've stopped the spill. They should now go and say, let's figure out what that plume was all about, because if that's the hole and the casing blew out, we have an enormous problem.
Yeah. So elaborate on that very quickly. You're saying that everybody's seeing the video, but they obviously can't analyze it the same way that you can. You're saying that the video that we're all now looking at right now is not the only leak. Is that what you're saying?
That's a tiny leak. And what the scientists are saying, watching this stain spread, is now bigger, I gather, than Maryland and Delaware, and several hundred feet thick, and this gooey stuff. That's not coming out of there. They think that's flowing at 120,000 barrels a day. It would almost have to be that big to flow that wide.
Yeah. And where do you believe the second outlet is relative to what we're seeing on the video, Matt?
Well, what the research vessel found a week ago Sunday was this giant plume about 6 miles away, and then this huge layer of goo on the ocean floor. That's almost certain that, I mean, maybe it's a natural fracture, but I think that's where the wellhead is.
We are all watching the continued gusher on ROV cameras, allegedly live. Surely Simmons can't keep to his idea that all that oil was coming from the remains in a pipe? Yet he repeated his claims weeks later on Bloomberg TV. This theory depends upon the idea that the well casing and the hole were severely damaged by the explosion. Then oil began to leak deep down, where it would follow fractures in the loose, muddy sea bottom of the Gulf, coming out further from the original well hole. If true, there would be no way to plug this leak unless BP can drill very, very deep below any leak and plug that. At first, Simmons sounded a little bit zany. I wondered if he had been drinking. However, information has since come out, reported by Bloomberg, among others, that Stephen Hsu, heading the government science team, advised ending that top kill maneuver because so much drilling mud was leaking out from the casing another 1,000 feet down, where a disc had been ruptured. We also have reasonable statements that BP gave up attempts to plug the leak at the top, expressly because the deeper damage, combined with the extreme pressure of the oil and gas coming from below, could cause the wellhead and blowout preventer to just migrate away, leaving a gaping hole that could never be controlled. We know this could still happen, partly because the escaping material is eating away at all the metal in the casing and the equipment day after day. The wellhead really could blow off. And if you travel around the web, you can also find ROV footage taken away from the main leak, showing what looks to be oil bubbling up from cracks in the seabed. I've seen these myself. It is possible, even likely, that the well is leaking in other places in the surrounding area. But only BP ROVs are allowed to go down there. Film director Cameron's pleas to put independent cameras down in the Gulf were turned down by BP and the Obama administration on very slim reasons. Is there something they don't want us to see? Oops, I'm getting into conspiracy land myself. But it seems ludicrous to take whatever BP feeds us with no independent eye on the scene. And until we get that, the jury will have to stay out on the claims made by Matt Simmons. You don't have to depend on the Russians to find experts who predict this Gulf well could leak for a very long time. Matt Simmons has also suggested this blowout could go on for years. Respected experts suggest it could continue at least until December, and I think that is possible. After all, it took 9 months for U.S. contractors hired by the Mexican government to stop the Ixtoc well in 1979, and that was only a few hundred feet deep. The mainstream media keeps repeating BP predictions that the relief well will totally handle the leak by August, like a sacred mantra. Really, there should be several relief wells in progress, because it often takes several tries to hit that small target. In fact, I'm going to add BP and the press to this crazy conspiracy list when they talk about fixing this problem on a certain date. Over and over, we've heard extreme promises parroted without question by the nightly news and the daily newspapers. That's a conspiracy theory to calm the public waters and the stock markets. And when we hear BP executives or Obama and his officials promising to clean it all up and restore the ecology of the Gulf, that's the most absurd claim I've ever heard. Humans don't know how.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock, with your host, Alex Smith.
Dr. Jack Alpert has been a project engineer for General Motors, a lecturer at the University of Wisconsin, a training guru in Silicon Valley, and a longtime research director of the Stanford Knowledge Integration Laboratory, where he investigates blind spots in the human mind. I met him in April 2010 at the Vancouver Degrowth Conference. Jack Alpert, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you, Alex.
Well, let's begin at the beginning with the revelation you encountered back in the late 60s, trying to get people just to wear seatbelts in their cars. That simple step saved lives, but lots of folks refused to use them. What did that tell you?
Well, I really didn't know what it told me in the beginning. I was just a very frustrated engineer who thought he had added some really large improvement to an automobile, like not being injured. And people couldn't recognize it as having utility. So, and they could also recognize that it slowed them down 10 seconds to put it on, it wrinkled their clothes, it rubbed up against their neck, and so they had many reasons for not wearing it. And those reasons looked big, and the reason for wearing it, which is not being injured when you crash, looked small. It was a matter of discomfort. Then I recognized that there were other problems in the world which had the same kind of benefit as a seatbelt. Seatbelts, one out of every 200 Americans were dying in their car when I started this in 1968. So everybody knew somebody was, you know, dead because of a car accident in their group of 200 friends. Injuries that sent you to the hospital were 8 times higher. So one out of every 25 people ended up in the hospital for a car accident. Along comes seatbelts, and those numbers just rapidly changed to, if you're wearing your seatbelt, only 1 in 26,000 people, somewhere in that number, it's been debated, died in a car accident if they were wearing seatbelts. So, you know, if you wore your seatbelt, you just about didn't die, unless you drove underneath a semi or got squished by, you know, a train. So anyway, the number was 1 in 200 versus 1 in 26,000, wear your seatbelt. Well, it turns out that polio vaccinations also had a very similar drop in injury if you got vaccinated. And people, mothers who got their kids vaccinated, still wouldn't wear their seatbelts, even though the benefit ratio was the same. And that really made me quit. And so I studied the nuances of systems in motion and realized that the auto safety problem was a different kind of a problem than deciding whether or not to get vaccinated. And one they could give meaning to, or they adopted meaning from their culture, you know. Bad mothers wouldn't have their kids vaccinated. Good mothers get their kids vaccinated. So they had some other mechanism for making the decision. And that mechanism wasn't around for seatbelts until the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration caused people to put laws that said, you've got to buckle your kid up in an approved safety seat, and he's got to be in the back seat. That really helped. And so now people wear their seatbelts because of those rules and those habits and that culture. But if it came to deciding to wear a seatbelt because, you know, it has a benefit that you recognize, they still wouldn't wear them. And in fact, experientially, people would put their seatbelt on 500 times. They wouldn't have an accident. And the question is, what did they experientially learn from all those seatbelt bucklings? And the answer is not to wear a seatbelt. So from experience, it's very hard in some situations to get yourself to learn the benefit.
Well, you give a good example in a video at your site, skill.org, and it explains why it's a mistake for someone to put out their arm to stop an unbelted child, let's say if there still was one, from hitting the dashboard in a 35-mile-per-hour crash. And that example seems to lead to more about this weakness in human thinking. So why, briefly, is it a mistake, and why do our instincts work against us?
Well, our instincts work against us because what happens when you have an accident is really a series of things, some of which you know something about, some of which you don't. You're driving down the road, and somebody pulls out, and you step on the brakes, and there's enough time to stop, and you learn from that experience that that bag of groceries on the seat is going to end up on the floor if you don't put your arm out to hold it. So that part of it, of this unfolding event called an auto accident, you know all about. And you're conditioned to put your arm out and stop that unbelted child from crashing into the dashboard, because if you let him, he'd chip his tooth, or he'd get a black and blue eye, or he would, you know, get some sort of a bump or bruise, and it would be the irresponsible parent for not putting out their arm. But an accident actually is both the bump into the dashboard and slowing the whole vehicle down to zero from 35 miles an hour. So what happens is, if you don't put your arm out and step on the brakes, the child flies forward into the dashboard and does get the bump that you're worrying about. However, now that he's up against the dashboard, when the actual crash occurs, he slows down the 30 miles an hour the car is going to zero in the 12 inches that the dashboard slows down because of the front-end crush. So if the front-end crush is 12 inches, the dashboard actually slows down in those 12 inches. If the child is up against the dashboard at that point, he sees the forces that he would that the dashboard saw, which were only 20 G's. 20 G's may seem like a lot, but it isn't injurious to the skull. Whereas the parent that put his arm out to hold the child back, he could hold the child back during the braking part of the accident, but when the car strikes the wall or the tree, then the child suddenly can't be held back, because now he's working against that 20 G's, and that means the arm, if the child weighed 40 pounds, the arm would have to hold back 20 times 40, which is 800 pounds, and the arm can't do that. So the kid flies forward through the air, but what's different is that when he finally gets to the dashboard, it stopped. It's already gone through that nice 20G deceleration, and it's standing there still, and the head comes along at the original 30 miles an hour and crashes into the instrument panel, which may be dents an inch. So the difference between stopping in 12 inches and stopping in 1 inch is the difference between living and dying. It's much higher. It's almost 200 Gs, 10 times higher. So the parent, by doing his responsible act of holding the kid back during braking, is in essence creating the condition where the child's going to see 200 Gs, and that kills them. So the parents, working on their experience, seeing part of the accident unfolding, makes the injury to the child 10 times worse.
Well, it seems to me we're talking about situations in technology for which nature never prepared us. And I think that's going on again as we look at this drilling oil wells a mile below the surface of the sea. And it turns out we don't really have a solution if they blow out. Do you see that as possibly an application of this idea of mental blindness?
I think you have to go through the scenarios, which people don't like to do. They like to learn things by experience. One of the things that I did at graduate school was I created an interactive computer exam to test, give a child an environment in which he got to manage these systems that unfold over time. And the long and short of it was that the sixth graders didn't do very well on the test. That, you know, if they had to plan for 4 or 5 years, and the behavior in the first year would actually determine the conditions that he had to make decisions in the second year and so on, that in problems like that, sixth graders don't do a good job. Well, then I gave it to a bunch of graduate students who got to be better than the average sixth grader, and they didn't do better either. And then I said, well, I'm on to something here. So then I gave the test to a bunch of faculty members, and the faculty members were from a wide range, mathematics, operations research, engineering, sociology, political science, psychology. I mean, it was a, you know, these are people who were friends of mine, and they were willing to give me a shot, so they did. And unfortunately, the data comes back, and now this is not a real good experiment because it doesn't have enough people in it to make conclusive results. But the inference is, since the faculty didn't do any better than the sixth graders, at least for this small sample, that if you ran a full-blown test, the faculty wouldn't do any better than sixth graders, and so there are some kinds of problems where people don't want to run through the scenarios to see where they're going to end up, and they don't believe in them. The crown jewel of this little experiment, which only had a couple of people involved in it, and that was, you know, people like Nobel laureates and Wolf Prize winners, and it turns out that they're in no better shape than the sixth graders. So what you're looking for is, what does this problem look like, that faculty and sixth graders are no better prepared, and the answer is people like to solve their problems by trial and error.
But if the error is fatal, we don't get that chance.
That's right. While we get the chance, we die.
Okay.
We die. I mean, think of it this way. You live in a world exactly like our world, and there are bicycles in it exactly like our bicycles. And it turns out that because of the surface of the road, if you fall down once and grind a hole in your elbow, you get a virus that kills you. So there's no falling down allowed, because if you fall down, you get abraded and you die. On the other hand, bicycles are really good transportation. And if you can learn to ride them without falling down, then they're great service. So the question is, how would you learn to ride a bicycle if you couldn't do it by trial and error? The other question is, how would you know when you looked at the bicycle that here's a thing that you want to learn, but you don't want to learn by trial and error because it has this terrible outcome? And you got to know it before the fact, especially if nobody's ever seen a bicycle before, nobody's ever fallen down on the pavement before. You have to be able to say, what's coming down the road? So the problems that we're having in our society with global warming or peak oil, these are problems that are going to manifest themselves in the future. Nobody's experienced them in the past. And if they're really going to be terrible and billions of people are going to starve because of these mistakes, then we shouldn't do it by trial and error. We shouldn't use the current science model. We should be able to build scenarios. And we mean the scenarios aren't always accurate, and sometimes they predict things are going to happen early or later. But recognize that if water levels rise a couple of meters, or the places where we used to grow food, we can't grow food because they don't get any rain, we're playing with fire.
And you also bring up the example that's used. It's a simple one in most biology classes, the reproduction of plants in a lily pond. And you ask the question, you know, if they double in such a period, when will the lily pond be full? And I thought about that, and I think that most people, if you did a sort of jaywalking thing down on the street and ask people that question, if it doubles every day, when will it be full? They'll say halfway through the period rather than on the very last day, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's a common error. You know, that's because they're guessing rather than running the numbers. If the pond can only contain 32 lilies and you say it doubles, well, that's one lily on the first day, two lilies on the second day, four lilies on the third day, and they keep going when they get to the eighth lily, 16, oh, yeah, on the fifth day. On the sixth day, it'll be full.
But I brought this lily pond case up precisely because you say humans are not lilies. Unlike plants, we don't passively die off. And from this and other studies you've done, you have predicted we may be entering a new age of conflict and violence. Why would you say that?
Well, when the lilies fill up the pond, they got 32 lilies total. Okay, and when the pond is half full, that means it'll be 16 lilies. What happens is, as the pond gets really close to the 32 number, there's no space for the next lily. To have another lily, one of the original 32 has to die. And that lily doesn't know that it's old, or it doesn't know that it's aged, or that it's young and weak, or that it's not getting enough light. So it does what it can, but then it just goes away. And there's only room for 32 lilies in this pond. The difference for humans is that they're going to see before the fact that there's only room for 32 lilies, 32 people in this particular environment, and they want to be the surviving lily, the surviving person. So they're pretty aggressive about making sure they stay where the sun can hit them and the food is arriving, and they push the other ones out of the way. Now, the thing that makes the human condition much, much worse is that a lily just consumes what it needs, but humans don't. Humans consume whatever they want. So if the pond can support 32 humans, if one human wants 4 units of what the pond has to offer, suddenly the pond is only servicing 28 lilies. One of those guys is taking 4 units.
Well, I think that leads right into one of the articles that you wrote about the roots of terrorism, where you suggested that excess consumption in the West or by the very rich may actually be killing other people elsewhere in the world. You write, quote, "Each of us by living in the developed world is doing the same harm to our fellow humans as if we shot someone who was 23 years old to prevent him or her from consuming resources for the rest of his potential life." So is that what you're getting to, that really the more we want, and there seems to be no limit to how much we do want, the less these millions, hundreds of millions of other people in the world can get on a planet with limited resources?
I think that's pretty clear. I think everybody knows that 80% of the resources of the world go to 20% of the people. And the rest of the 80% of the people are only consuming 20% of the resources. So you have to visualize what that looks like. I think that if that 20% increases their well-being 25%, then they can consume all the resources that 80% of the people are consuming. They can just buy them up because they can buy the land, they can have that land grow coffee or flowers or grain or whatever they want and ship it to their location. Because they can pay more for that grain than the person who used to be eating it. It's not very hard for the 20% haves in the world to consume all of the remaining grain that they're not consuming. And that means 80% of the population could die simply because when they go to the grocery store or the market, that the cost of what they used to buy has gone up so much that their labor and the money they brought with them, it no longer purchases what they used to eat. I guess my personal belief is that the haves of the world just doing their normal thing, improving their lives, improving the Chinese. Think of the Chinese. 1.3 billion people, and they haven't been eating a lot of meat, but they can in the future because they've been working really hard, and they got all these dollars, and they can purchase the grain on the open market, and they can grow pigs with it, and they're going to eat. It doesn't sound like they're doing a bad thing, but all by themselves, they can take the food, even if the United States doesn't improve a whit. The Chinese just improving a little, and they're not living anywhere near our lifestyle. If they just improve 10 or 15%, they can take the food out of a billion people's mouths. And my feeling is that event, you know, the new consumers not even being egregious, just being normal people trying to get half or a quarter what the people in the United States have as their standard of living, they will take the food out of a billion people's mouths in the next decade. At least that's how I run the numbers. If the price of fuel goes up to $5 a gallon in the United States, there will be a billion people who will be priced out of their food market. Now, what's happened in places like Egypt, the government subsidizes bread so that people can afford it. But I don't know if these governments will be able to continue subsidizing bread if it doubles in value. And that's what's going to happen as the Chinese begin to feed their pigs and start eating meat. Even if they do it at, you know, 5% of the level of the people in the United States, it'll be doubled from what they used to have. And the draw of world grain into the Chinese diet all by itself, even if the United States didn't change its well-being, which it will try and do if it can, and so will every other person in the world. It doesn't make any difference who used to be poor. Whoever is the newly improved financial person will take the food out of the mouths of the weakest financial person. I think the first billion in the next 10 years will go kind of quietly. We'll watch them on TV like we watch Darfur or Rwanda. And Rwanda is a good example because I think if you look closely, if you do your research, you'll find out that the CIA has got some pretty good programs about modeling civilizations. They modeled the Rwanda civilization, and they expected it to go unstable, and it did. It did. There was enough people moving downward in well-being, they could point their finger at another group that was they blamed it on, and then they went unstable and they killed. And I don't see that being a strange event. I see that being an event that will be repeated over and over again.
Well, it happened in Europe in World War II. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith here with Dr. Jack Alpert, a longtime corporate trainer. He's a teacher and an investigator of the human mind. But Jack, we're talking really about a very important point, which you call temporal blindness. You've applied it very much to the need for rapid population reduction, which we can get to in a minute, and we ran a bit about that on our previous Radio EcoShock show. But it also applies to other social problems like peak oil and climate change, as you say. Could you explain to us the basics of temporal blindness?
Well, it came from the seatbelt example. What are the characteristics of an environment which we normally do not see? And because we don't see them, we don't let the images that kind of thinking, those images don't influence our behavior. Not to get too detailed, there are three ways to learn, okay? You want to learn something like A causes B. And the most common way to learn A causes B is that A is an imaginary action in your head, which you can then get your hands to facilitate in the real world. And then you look around and you see what changed in the real world and you say, well, that's a B. And then you connect A causes B. That's how we learn to play catch. A causes B. Notice that the A, the action, started in your head and used the real world as the processor and your senses to gather the B. So B's outside and A's from inside. Okay, there's another way to learn. The second way is by transmission. When you learn by transmission, somebody else has already connected an A and a B and either incorporated them in a sentence or put them in a book and you got to read them. And all you needed to learn A causes B is the ability to read the sentence. Notice that both the A part and the B part and the connective came from outside as a package. The third way to learn is called inference. Inference is the ability to have an A, an action, a model in your head of the physical world, and the ability to turn the crank of that model. So you have an A, and you stick it in your model of the world, and you turn the crank, and whatever comes out of your little machine is your B. So notice that the A part and the B part were both inside the head. So those are the three ways to learn a relationship A causes B. Now the question is, where do we get the skills to manage each type of those three learnings? For experience, when you see a small child learning to play catch, he mimics your throw but doesn't look where he throws the ball. Okay, so he's getting a feel for the throw and he throws it, you pick it up, put it back in his hand, he throws it again, but he really can't learn how to throw the ball until he has a couple of things in place. One is remembering the throw, which he can do, but B, he has to have a destination for where the throw is supposed to go. And C, he has to be able to say it went not to that point, but to some other point. And D, I have some algorithm for modifying the throw so that if it went to the right, I throw it a little bit more to the left. And so experientially, those buckets are created, or they were in your toolbox to begin with, but they're tied together and developed so that each time you try to learn something by experience, you say, I'm going to do this, but this time I'm going to remember the throw. And this time I'm going to pick a destination, and this time I've got to make sure I see where it lands, because I can't fix my throw until I can make a little difference here. I'm saying that the world is robust enough for you to learn by experience, because you can put those primitives in place. Second thing is, the same sort of strategy works for learning by transmission. Now, we get to the third one, inference. This is where the bugs in our thinking are developed. To do an inference, you do have to have a model of the world that works. And you do have to be able to put an A into it. And most importantly, when your machine produces not B, but C, the wrong answer, you have to be able to say, I wonder what I did to create a machine that produced the C instead of the B. Now, think about what happens in high school when you're in a classroom and the teacher's asking questions about a reading assignment, and the first kid who gets called on didn't do the reading assignment, so he has to infer the answer. So he infers a C. Okay, whatever mechanism he used to produce a C, I don't know, but the idea is that he did produce a C, and it was wrong. So what does the teacher in the classroom do? He asks another student, what does A imply? That student did the reading. He doesn't have to infer anything. He just says A implies B. Teacher looks at the first student and says, got it? And the child says, yes, A implies B. And you go on. question is, when do you get to go back and say, why did I create this machine that predicted C instead of B? And the answer is, you never did. Now, that means that you can be a very functional, very bright individual with no inference capabilities. And that's exactly what happens. We don't have very good inference capabilities because our attentive parents have answered every question they possibly can, telling us the answer so that we know it, and we don't have to go back and rebuild our inference machine ever. Now, the small piece of inference that I work in is called temporal inference, and temporal inference is how we manage systems that are in motion, and how do we learn to predict what systems in motion are going to do when we haven't experienced them and we haven't been coached, sort of like a car accident, or like making sure the world doesn't run off the energy cliff. So that kind of thinking, the temporal inference primitives are not in place. And what I've done for 30 years at before and during and after my stint at Stanford University was to try and understand what kinds of processes could actually keep or develop these primitives in the human mind. And the reason I say keep is because there's pretty good information done by a woman in British Columbia on infants that says you're born with an ability to hear 100 different sounds that the mouth can make. And by the time you're 6 months old, an infant is only paying attention to the 26 sounds that the parents are using to communicate. The logical question is, what happened to all the other sounds? And the answer is, you can still hear them. The Swahili clicks and the rolled R's that aren't in English. You can still hear all those. However, they're not speech. They don't have your speech processors going the second they hear them. It's sort of like you don't start your speech processors when you hear a door slam. So the idea is we probably have, from my theories, and you can go to my website, skill.org, and look up under temporal blindness. Go look at the books. There's two books. The second one contains information about process model learning theory, which suggests there are some things that we can do in the learning environments of very small children, 6 days to 6 months, which will allow them to keep the temporal primitives so that they can do temporal inference, so that they can say, oh, our world's going to the wrong place. I really believe we're going to the wrong place, and I'm not gonna go there, and I can look around for behaviors to not go to that place. That's what the basic research is.
But, you know, considering civilization may depend upon us solving some of these problems, is it too late for those of us who didn't learn this inference process in infancy? Is there something we can do about it?
I think that you can learn about the world and you can gain a feeling for bad future events if your mind is willing to throw away your fantasies. I don't think that you can change your cognitive processes so that you can do it forward, as I suggested, meaning grow a child between 6 days and 6 months that learns that keeps new cognitive primitives or old cognitive primitives. They don't go away. You're not going to be tuned up to do that. I have no mechanism for you to become a person who can generate from your cognitive abilities inferred images of the future. What I can do is I can break your fantasies and I can offer you some new images which I think are more supported than your fantasies were. Now, whether or not they'll take root and become entrenched, I don't know. But what I do know is that my current effort to change the world has to do with, can I talk to a grandmother, not the Pope, not the President, not the Prime Minister, just a grandmother who has some grandchildren? Can I convince her, using language that she understands, that they are in extreme danger? Can I convince her that rapidly decreasing population has a higher probability of keeping her children from being crushed by a collapsing civilization than any other behavior, than any other trend? And then it's one more jump for to say whether or not this grandmother will then vote for something on a ballot, because I'm a great believer of not doing this from the top down, but I believe that you need a groundswell of people from the bottom up. You need grandmothers. And the grandmothers can vote. If they were given an option to vote for a one-child limit or something even more stringent than that, a lottery for the number of births in a nation, that they could vote for that. And they could vote for that for a good reason. And they could vote for it where a corporate president or a corporate lobby or a religious lobby or a environmental lobby or a anti-immigration lobby, those people aren't going at it at the level at which I think is important. The question is, could mothers and grandmothers in the United States elect any president they wanted? And the answer is, sure they could. There are 60 million people voted in the last election for one party, and 60 million voted for the other. Just a few votes difference between them. But the answer is, there are 80 million mothers in the United States, and they could have elected a third party guy, and the third party guy says, don't care about economics, don't care about the war in Vietnam or Afghanistan or any of the ones in between. What I do care about is that we need a design to get to a future where our children are not going to be crushed. And all 80 million mothers says, yep, that's what I want. I really don't care about those other things. I care about the fact that my child's going to have a chance in the future. And so she elects the president or the House or the representative or the senator. And those, once the Senate is full of people that believe we need rapidly decreasing population and we can pass an amendment because we've already got a majority of the voters, then the question is, can the Supreme Court be modified so that they can see farther down the pipe and that their decisions today are not only got to be constitutional, but they have to be viable, that we don't want the United States to go down the drain. So the Supreme Court can say the thing that governs this, whether or not this law of limiting people's procreation behaviors is constitutional or not constitutional or important for the nation or not important for the nation, they'll be biased. They will be biased. They got kids too, but they've been elected by this incredible cohort, or they've been put on the bench by a cohort of senators, which were put in place by these grandmothers. And so that's my model for change.
Boy, it's a tough one because, if I take this on a three-step plan here, we have to disabuse people of their fantasies of an ever-expanding consumption of bigger houses, bigger cars, and more riches forever. And then we have to substitute that the likely very dangerous scenarios that are developing out of dwindling energy and climate change and disappearing species and all of that sort of thing. And then we have to ask grandmothers to vote for there being fewer grandmothers and, in fact, to try and persuade their own families to have fewer grandchildren for them. And if we could do that, maybe we could save future generations.
Well, I agree with you. Back at the first jump, the very first jump was that we have to disabuse them of their fantasies.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I don't think that's hard to do. I think that there's enough simple steps going forward, they can see that that belief is a fantasy. It isn't going to happen. Now, the second part of this is equally important. You said that they're not allowed bigger houses and they're not allowed more robust lives. And the answer to that question is that's not true at all. If the population decreases fast, each person gains huge resources per person. And let's ask the question, how many parents did you have, Alex?
How many parents do I have?
Yeah.
Two.
And how many grandparents do you have?
Four.
And how many great-grandparents do you have?
Presumably eight.
Okay. Let's assume that all of those people were only children. Then if you follow heredity, what you would inherit, which means you get more stuff without taking it away from anybody else, it means you would be born into one house. By the time you were 30, you'd have two houses. By the time you were 60, you'd have four houses, and by the time you were 90, you'd have eight. So did you end up with more stuff or less stuff with rapidly decreasing population? I have no belief that we're ever going to get people to live smaller. That is not a scalable solution. There's no reason to believe that you can't have more and more and more. When you have eight houses and you're 90 years old, you can't turn the lights on in all of them. You can't flush the toilets in all of them. So there's a bit of economies of scale here. Suddenly, there's an abundance of housing. And you tear down the worst ones and you keep the good ones. And the other side of the coin is people are worried that they won't have anybody to take care of them in old age. With this inheritance model, they're the richest people in the community. And they got all this stuff. And they can sell it. And they can live off of it. Rapidly decreasing population does not mean living smaller, less travel, less education, less rapid population decline means you can have a lot more stuff and your footprint is still shrinking.
Wow. Well, we're starting to run out of time. Is there anything that we've left out or something that you would like to add?
Well, I think that the key thing to understand for everybody in this business of, you know, what's going on in our world, where are we going, what do we want to get done, who's going to be injured and who isn't, the most important thing that I can say, or if I was successful, would be that we're underestimating the human predicament and we're overestimating our ability to muddle through with some of the solutions that have been proposed to us. If you have one kid instead of two, it would be okay to live a little bit higher on the hog because your consumptive stream diminishes enormously. So let's assume that you have this couple, they're about to have kids, and the government comes to you and says, you have one kid. If you decide not to have a second kid, we're going to give you a Humvee. And all the environmentalists go, oh, that's a terrible idea. That'll be enormously consumptive. But if the parents take the deal, driving their Humvee around or driving their second kid around, there's no comparison. The Humvee's a lot smaller, almost immediately. And in fact, if they were willing to have no kids, we could give them two Humvees, and it would still be smaller. If you lengthen the time frame, the benefit gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So the idea is this whole concept of recycling, which is nice, and for compact fluorescents, which are enormously efficient and better, those things don't scale because the next generation can't get more out of the same. Those big jumps are not of it. It's like saying if we had a car and went from 25 to 50 miles per gallon and the next year it went from 50 to 100, all right, now you're done. You're not going to be able to move your body around 200 miles for the gallon. But you can, the next generation, have one child, and that does exactly have it. And it keeps going for generation after generation until you get down to such a low level that when somebody says, well, you can have an extra Learjet or you can have this bag lady living in your house, you'll take the bag lady because an extra Learjet doesn't have any benefit and the bag lady does. When people become valuable, more valuable than the stuff it takes to support them, the population will stop going down.
So you've got kind of a roadmap for this. Have you had very much support, or have you had some people criticizing you for it? When you talk about rapid, sustainable population reduction, what's been the reaction?
Well, I've been saying exactly. I wrote a dissertation in 1975 at the University of Wisconsin where I actually laid out the trends between population decline, increases in consumption, and social conflict. And so that's where I first started. That was the first time I actually wrote it down and showed it to somebody, and it's published, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, what's important is that it seemed really strange to people in the 70s because we were still on this incredibly steep belief that my life is going to be better than my parents' life. I got a better education. The jobs are paying more relative to what my father made. And so in 1975, and I started in 1968, which is really the go-go years, I had a hard sell, a much harder sell. But it's now 30 years later, 35 years later, and things have deteriorated so much that people don't think that they are going to be able to live as well as their parents. In fact, they're looking at living a lot less well. And from where they're standing, their kids are going to be living less well than they are. And they got the education. So it's a whole lot easier to sell now than it used to be because the world is different. People's optimism about ever improvement is gone, and the question is how far will I be sliding downward?
Well, all of that is bringing some successful pressure, I think, for people to have fewer children, and that's what we're talking about here. And I think we're going to have to wrap it up at that point. This has been just such a wild investigation and time with you, Jack, because I'm ricocheting off into how this applies to peak oil and to climate change and just the general development of our society, while we have this blind spot in our mental thinking that we don't even know we have the blind spot. So I know I'm going to be poring over this in weeks to come. Our guest has been Jack M. Alpert, an educator. He's a corporate trainer. And as you've seen, he's an investigator into the way the human mind works. He is the director of the Stanford Knowledge Integration Laboratory, which is now a nonprofit. And you can find out more at skill.org. That's skill.org. Thank you so much, Jack, for sharing all this with us.
Alex, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. broadcast on 20 stations in Canada and the United States. Going out over the world by satellite and cable, podcast and downloads, you've got Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Get tons of free MP3 downloads from our site at ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock. It's radioactive.